Hello, I'm Gareth Westwood, Head of Global Intelligence here at Civline, and welcome to another episode of Civline Insights, recorded on Monday the 31st of July from our central London office. Today, we've got a really busy show, and I'm delighted once again to be joined by Intelligence Delivery Lead and my co-host, Leo Collins.
Afternoon, Gareth.
Afternoon, Leo. So we've got a busy one today. Later, we will be speaking to Leila Guest about all things that Ukraine, Belarus, Wagner, especially in light of the most recent attacks in Moscow as well. We also have Kaylin from our cyber desk, who's going to call in and talk about zero days. But first of all, we have had emails. The flavor of the emails has been, Gareth, stop listing off a load of stuff that you'd never talk about at the beginning of the podcast. So with that, I sent you away, Leo, to look at the three things that our clients and our partners and friends were asking about most frequently. So to that end, what are we speaking about today?
So we're going to start off in Africa. We're going to look at what's been happening in Niger and what is happening in Niger. We're then going to travel a bit further east to Israel to look at the result of the fallout regarding the reasonableness bill.
Yeah, the new law.
The new law. And then we'll end up in China and we'll talk about the matter of the missing minister.
Foreign minister, yeah. Interesting. Well, loads to get through even with those. So shall we start with Niger then?
Sure.
I don't think it's been covered enough. I mean, from our standpoint, I know we issued two alerts last week as we're recording it. As we're recording today, we're issuing another alert on the ongoing unrest and the coup.
Sure.
Regional partners, ECOWAS, not happy about it at all.
Sure.
Put us in the picture. You've been reading about this, haven't you?
Sure. So as you say, it's a new coup. It's the fourth coup in 3 years. We've had one in Burkina Faso and we've had two in Mali. And now another Sahelian leader has been deposed. However, this is looking to be a mutiny without a bounty, if you want, because there's a lot of people, a lot of investors in the area who aren't happy with what's happened. We're talking France, we're talking the US, and as you mentioned, we're talking regional partners like ECOWAS. Basically, the same old narrative was used, a degrading security situation, economic woes and corruption, and so General Tchiani, who was the, ex-presidential guard leader of Bazoum, has taken power and is now saying that, you know, this is the new leadership, get used to it.
So this general, he isn't a general in the actual military, right? Like the regular army.
No, he's the presidential guard head who, you know, is still part of the armed forces. But this is like your sort of Praetorian guard, if you want, in terms of this is the group, this is the body that was responsible for the presidential security.
That's quite ironic then.
Yeah.
So the actual military I saw, the regular army, whatever, come out, I think it took them a day, didn't it? It was a very loose endorsement of this. So we don't think that the presidential guard, this general, has got any real sway within the military, right?
No, exactly. And there's a real kind of disparity in terms of the support for the coup as it stands. And really interestingly, if we compare this to the coups that took place in Burkina Faso and Mali, we have pretty strong assertions coming out of ECOWAS and foreign powers like France. France has come out and said, if any French citizen is attacked or harmed as a result of this coup, the response is going to be immediate and intractable. There are 1,500 French soldiers in Niger right now. This is its last, or at least one of its few remaining hubs in terms of its counterterrorism operations in the region. It's not going to give up lightly.
And I mean, with Mali, I remember the latest Mali coup, I remember ECOWAS shutting down the borders. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that had quite profound supply chain impacts on the ground. Do you think there's any chance of that happening this time, or more, do you see ECOWAS maybe getting involved militarily?
There's a realistic possibility of the latter. I think borders might already be closed, which is going to present its own kind of supply chain issues in terms of routes having to now be threaded through other regional powers. But yes, they haven't ruled out. In fact, they've explicitly said that we haven't ruled out military intervention. There was talk last year of an ECOWAS regional military force. We're not sure exactly what kind of form that has taken now, but as we've said, they've not ruled out military intervention.
And do we think the Niger, the regular military in Niger that have given this kind of quite tepid endorsement of the coup, do you think they would stand up and try to resist an ECOWAS military intervention or just lie down and take it?
But I think if it was just ECOWAS, you might see some kind of resistance militarily from the, as you say, the tepid armed forces that are currently in Niger. However, you've got to factor in the French and the US. There are 1,000 US troops based in Niger. They've got a very precious drone base in the north of the country in a place called Agadez. Again, this is a power that's not going to give up Niger easily. And if the Nigerian armed forces are faced with ECOWAS, France, and the US, they will fold. It's highly likely they will fold.
So ECOWAS has given them 1 week. Yep. Can they? As we're recording this now. So
there's a lot of there are a lot of ultimatums. ECOWAS has given them 1 week. The African Union has given them 15 days to restore constitutional order. Whether or not that happens, watch this space.
And on the ground, it's really quite febrile. This morning, as we're recording this, or maybe over the weekend, actually, I was speaking to Ben Manzin from the desk, the MIA desk. He said there was a protest outside the French embassy, and whilst eventually the security forces did mitigate that, it was probably them that stoked it, and this is, I guess, this is set against the wider backdrop of increasing anti-French, anti-Western sentiment in the Sahel.
Sure. Yeah, we've seen this before in both Burkina Faso and Mali. It's a case of France out, but interestingly, Russia, you can stay. Whether or not this is a result, it probably is, a result of Russian information operations. It's an ironic situation because on the one hand, we're seeing at the local level, anti-imperialist sentiment. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, we're seeing an endorsement of another foreign force in the form of Russia.
So in the short term then, lots of bystander risk, mm-hmm. supply chain governance impacts. We're putting out an alert today.
Sure.
So we're getting that out there. And of course, anybody listening or watching that wants to access any of our reporting and get up to date on this can give us a call or indeed send us an email. And I think our email address, as ever, is on the show notes. But as you say, let's go a little bit further east and let's go to Israel. Now, it's been a week now.
Sure.
Since the legislation that you mentioned in the introduction was passed, and it was passed, in the wake of tremendous protests, mm-hmm. Not just from civil society, but, former heads of Mossad, security, force, mm-hmm. Leaders, really objecting to what many are calling a decoupling from democracy. Now, we're not here today to actually talk policy. We're more here to talk about the implications going forward for organizations on the ground. But let's just step back and, this is, from what I can tell, the final, the only check on the executive being removed, because Israel doesn't have a House of Lords, second chamber.
No.
So am I right in saying this is, the only check on power,
sure.
on the executive is being removed here?
Yep, so it's the Supreme Court and essentially the reasonableness bill, that law. It means that in a few words, it means that the government, the right religious-led government, can appoint members who they want to a committee, which in itself appoints judges to the Supreme Court. So you can put essentially friendly judges in place. And there are cynics out there, or possibly realists, who say that, well, because Netanyahu's facing a range of legal challenges himself, this is a great way to make sure that he is able to ride that storm.
So the bill effectively allows legislation and policy to completely bypass
yep.
the judicial
100%.
Process.
Yeah.
And Israel for a long time has been the beacon of democracy, quote unquote, in the Middle East. Well, worrying times, but I think in the short term, we are seeing very tumultuous scenes. We're seeing, Israeli protesters.
Sure.
And from what I can see from some of the footage out there, these protests have been suppressed in a similar way you'd see actually security forces in the West Bank.
So this is where this situation very much is an aberration. It's not so often that you hear about something that's so purely Israeli in terms of the implications on the ground. Now, I think 5 people have been injured at least, and 19 people have been arrested. So by the usual kind of standards when it comes to unrest vis-a-vis Palestine, that's not that impactful. However, going back to something you mentioned earlier in terms of strikes, cross-sectoral strikes, what is going to be interesting is the upshot in terms of Israel's own security forces. Around 1,000 Air Force reservists pledged to strike if this bill went ahead. So this right religious-led government is incredibly inflammatory in terms of its rhetoric when it comes to Palestinian rights. This is a government that wants to expand into the West Bank. And yes, okay, tensions between Palestinians and Israelis are common, but not so much in the West Bank. And last year, the UN Human Rights Index said that the fatalities in the West Bank as a result of unrest were at their highest level yet. I think 150 or around that number died last year, and it's set to be even higher this year in terms of their predictions. So if you've got this right religious government stoking tensions through inflammatory rhetoric and you've got security personnel striking, that's going to lead to a lot more risk in terms of bystander safety.
And I mean, you know, I have heard spokespeople from the Israeli Defense Force come out and say they are postured to, operationalize whatever they stand up, you know, whatever mission they need to do. But you're right. And the reserve piece, I mean, some folks might not know, but actually the Israeli Defense Forces, you know, the reserve is a really integral part, you know, of that. So huge bystander risks. I wouldn't want to be on the ground in Tel Aviv. Not only do you have the security forces being really quite draconian, I think, from what I can see in their approach, as you say now, you know, this doesn't leave Israeli Arabs or Palestinians in a good place at all. No. You know, some of the views of Netanyahu's coalition, as you say, very inflammatory. So you got a multifaceted threat here.
Exactly, and there's a remote chance that the my enemy's enemy is my friend card might come to play, because if Palestinians who oppose the right religious government find a weird kind of ally in Israelis who also oppose the right religious government, but for completely different reasons, that'll be an interesting marriage to see how that works out. But the other upshot is that the more extreme elements, especially Gaza-based elements, might take advantage of the unrest or any potential escalation in unrest to cause trouble themselves.
Yeah. That's another dimension. And I'm just looking here at the one of the maps that are Mirdes produced. A lot of the protests, of course, around Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. I think we need to watch how it plays out. There's been little reaction from the international community. And at this stage, you know, does even the US have leverage? It seems that Netanyahu has thrown his hat in with these characters. And the upshot of that is that I can't see this, dying down anytime soon. I can only see further problems here. So, and for businesses operating in that area, extreme physical risk, as well as the governance risks, right?
And I would say that for the coming weeks, well, the Supreme Court is in a very tricky place right now, because it is being accused by the right religious-led government of being an interfering legal entity. Mm. Now, it's also being lobbied by a lot of watchdogs to strike down this bill as the highest legal authority in the country. But by doing that, it simply becomes what it's being accused of being, if that makes sense. Yeah. So it's in a very tricky place. It said it will listen to arguments in September. So that is that's a point where we might see escalation seriously ramp up. But until then, yeah, expect, because I think last weekend was the 30th consecutive weekend of protests across Israel. So, I mean, that's just, it's highly likely to maintain that momentum until September.
And horrendous to the people of Israel that could just sit back and watch this unfold. Okay, we are going to go even further east to a curious story. We put a report out, 5-6 days ago now, on the missing minister who's now been actually replaced. So yeah, what's this all about, Leo?
As much as it sounds like an Agatha Christie play, it's even more intriguing in many ways. Chinese state media revealed last week that Qin Gang had been removed from the post of foreign minister and replaced by his predecessor. However, the more curious thing about this is that Qin hasn't been seen in a month. The last time he was seen publicly was on the 25th of June with, I think, the Russian Deputy Defense Minister. And this is a story that points ultimately to the capriciousness and the opacity of the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party. Xi Jinping, the president, was supposed to have cemented his grip on power last year when he was basically approved for an unprecedented third term via the 20th Congress. And unfortunately, nothing contradicts stability and predictability like the mysterious disappearance of a very high-ranking member.
Yeah, and I mean, everyone will be thinking, well, first we're going to go on to implications because we don't see this as in the short term having any significant policy implications, although it's very curious. But many asking, why is it health issues? There's some kind of salacious allegations out there. It's time when he was ambassador in the US.
Sure.
Breaking disciplinary rules, possibly having some kind of fear. Who are we to speculate? Maybe we can get one of our APAC desk on. But this is essentially the end of his political career progression.
100%. And this guy, Chin, he was a rising star, which is in itself a real indicator and warning if you're trying to work out when someone might suddenly disappear. But as you say, he was the ambassador to the US, fluent in English, and was also, importantly, he was a real kind of enabler when it came to approaching the matter of mending or bettering relations between the West and China. You know, he facilitated a visit by Emmanuel Macron in April. He helped to organize the meeting between US President Joe Biden and Xi Jinping in November last year. You know, he was someone who was moving away from the wolf warrior approach of many hardliners within the CCP. And unfortunately, his disappearance shows that there is factionalism. Mm. As much as Xi is the man in charge, as soon, you know, people will band together if they perceive a threat to their hardline policy. And that's likely what's happened here.
Possibly a bit too moderate.
Exactly.
And I mean, when you know, it's a very curious story, but it's very dangerous when you have a personality cult-led administration that actively purges anyone that can speak truth to power, deliver bad news, be the moderate face in the room. When you have such a multifaceted threat landscape, you've got the China, the South China Seas, you've got China, Taiwan, it's looking to increase its nuclear capacity. Sure. It's no joke. So it is worrying to see, you know, this chipping away of adults in the room.
Yeah, and for businesses, the lack of transparency that's been put on show here by Chin's removal, let's call it removal, it's going to hurt foreign investors' confidence when it comes to investing in Beijing, especially at a time when the West is trying to decouple from China's economy. If China's foreign policy reverts to this wolf warrior mode, investors are going to reassess expanding in China, given the mounting geopolitical risks and supply chain issues.
Absolutely. Now, I did ask Hugo on our Asia Pacific desk if this altered the dial for China-Taiwan conflict. Not really, but you know, I think you did acknowledge, and we'll have to bring him on, it's worrying. This is a worrying precedent.
Sure.
I think. But with that, I think we possibly have to leave it there, Leo. However, before we do go to the interview with Leila, we've actually got a call in from Kaylin on our cyber desk, who wanted to speak a little bit about Zero Day. So let's have a listen.
Good morning, all. On the cyber desk, we've noticed a substantial increase of the utilization of zero-day vulnerabilities by both state-sponsored APT groups as well as organized crime groups in supply chain attacks. We've been seeing an increasing focus by groups on exploiting the trusted relationships between vendors and their consumers as an attack vector to conduct both widespread destructive attacks as well as highly targeted espionage campaigns. Due to the prevalent usage of third-party vendors in businesses' day-to-day operations, there will be sustained operational and security risks posed to businesses globally, particularly within the government sector.
That's really interesting. I think supply chain attacks aren't new. I mean, going back to 2010, Olympic Games, otherwise known as Stuxnet, that was a classic supply chain attack. However, what was very interesting about Stuxnet was reliance on 0 days. They're very, very expensive, very rare. And it's quite alarming to see these being used more capriciously now, because there's quite literally zero patches for 0 days, right? It's in the definition. So supply chain attacks increasing, and a worrying trend in the increases of 0 days. Might get Kaylin on at some point to parse that out. But Leo, as I said, that's pretty much all we got time for. Thank you so much for coming on again, and we look forward to seeing you again.
Pleasure as always. Thank you, Gareth.
Well, as we're recording this on the 31st of July, we've seen Ukraine continue to take the fight to Russia with some drone strikes over the weekend on Moscow. It seems like a week is an awful long time in the war in Ukraine, and it seems now a distant memory when a former hot dog salesman launched an attempted mutiny or coup on Moscow. Well, at the time, Sibylline covered it extensively, as we did the eventual deal that saw Yevgeny Prigozhin and his Wagner fighters abscond to Belarus. The question we're being asked is, where are they now, what are they doing, and what threat do they pose? To begin to answer this, I'm delighted to be welcomed by an analyst from our Eurasia desk, Leila Guest. Welcome.
Hi, Gareth. Thank you for having me.
So, Leila, it does seem like an age away now, but not to you folks on the Eurasia desk who are covering this pretty much every day. Now, we could go into the, you know, where are they now? What about Africa? So many avenues to this. But I think the logical place to start is, how did Wagner end up in Belarus in the first place? And this might be going a bit over old ground, but just put us in the picture.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, Belarus, Wagner ending up in Belarus was definitely not something that I expected in 2023 by any means. However, essentially what happened to end the mutiny on the 23rd and 24th of June, it was agreed that Yevgeny Prigozhin, the leader of the Wagner group, would move to Belarus under the deal brokered by Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko. So, following the mutiny, Russian President Vladimir Putin offered Wagner fighters three options: to sign contracts with the Russian MOD by 1st of July. And this is what we have assessed was the catalyst for this mutiny, given that all volunteer formations were supposed to sign contracts with the MOD by this date. So the other option was for Wagner fighters to go home to their friends and family, or alternatively, go to allied Belarus. So, since this whole debacle with Wagner and their mutiny, it does seem relatively unclear still as to what was actually agreed to, you know, end the mutiny, given that Prigozhin has gone to and from Belarus and Russia since the end of June. I mean, last recently, he was spotted at the Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg. So that shows that he's still going between the two quite frequently. So that is how Wagner has ended up in Belarus.
Okay, so Yevgeny Prigozhin clearly not staying in Belarus, here, there, and everywhere. It's fascinating what they agreed, whether we'll ever know. But in terms of the group itself, then, how many of them do we estimate are in Belarus at the moment?
So numbers are very much varied. I mean, we have seen a steady build-up of Wagner convoys entering Belarus throughout July. Satellite imagery does show military technical equipment being built up at a camp in eastern Belarus near Asipovichi in Mogilev Oblast. And according to a monitoring group, Belaruski Hygin, at least 13 convoys have entered Belarus so far. These convoys tend to include different kinds of vehicles. So in terms of personnel numbers, this monitoring group has said around 3,500 Wagner fighters are in Belarus so far. However, a Wagner commander has said around 10,000 troops are set to deploy to Belarus. So that's very considerable numbers here.
So what are they doing there then? Well, I mean, what activity have we seen? What are they just chilling out there, like summer camp? What are they doing?
Well, I would say, based on what Prigozhin has said so far, that Wagner are going to spend some time in Belarus before eventually going to Africa. So that is, I would say, their main priority will be going to Africa. However, what we have seen in the interim is the Belarusian Defense Ministry state that mercenaries from Wagner were training Belarusian special forces on the border with Poland. So, of course, this is something that's going to cause quite a stir, given, you know, Belarus's history of using migrants and pushing them forward at the border to stir problems, you know, with Poland and Lithuania and Latvia, these EU member states.
So, I mean, you mentioned Lithuania, Latvia, Poland. Have they reacted to this buildup of Wagner on their borders?
Yes. So Poland began moving at least 1,000 troops to the east of the country in early July amid rising concern over Wagner presence in Belarus. The three presidents of Poland, Latvia and Lithuania, they all wrote a letter to NATO as well, expressing their concern over Wagner in Belarus. And they have issued warnings and various statements at different at different points these weeks. So it shows that the threat to them is very real and that the concerns over a renewed migrant crisis are still very much fresh in the minds of these, you know, of these states.
So from what the desk is seeing, then, do they actually pose a threat to Poland, Lithuania, etc.? Or, you know, are Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, etc., being just justifiably paranoid?
I would say at present, obviously, there has been a lot of military technical equipment being moved into Belarus. But we have to remember as well that Wagner also did allegedly give up a lot of their equipment back to Russia earlier this month. So at present, it's unclear exactly how much material they have that would be of worth of a credible attack. But Wagner itself would be, I think, very reticent to launch a full-scale attack against Lithuania, Poland, or, you know, Latvia. But it seems, from what we can see, a lot of this is rhetoric. Lukashenko himself did say that Wagner are pressing Minsk to go on an excursion into Warsaw, the capital of Poland, and Rzeszów, which is a main hub for transporting Western aid. But such comments are likely designed to stir up panic in NATO and EU member countries rather than present an actual threat itself.
I mean, Russia, Wagner, Putin, like nothing more than NATO states to overreact to this, right? So they can then, you know, justify what they've been trying to, the line that they've been putting out for since the beginning of the war. I mean, does Lithuania, Poland, Latvia, these three states in particular, do you think, are you a bit worried that they might overreact and retaliate to these threats, to the buildup of troops on the border? Or do you think, you know, NATO's very much got their back and they're aware that an over-retaliation could be catastrophic? So what are you seeing? Are they going to retaliate?
Well, it depends as to how we're going to class retaliation. So Poland's interior minister did say that Latvia, Lithuania and Poland could decide to close their borders to Belarus if there are serious provocations along the border involving Wagner. This sort of rhetoric would make sense, and I do not think that this would be an overstep considering that Poland has... There's been a lot of back and forth with Belarusian and Poland's borders this year. I mean, Poland essentially decided to close its border with Belarus to Belarusian and Russian freight vehicles from 1st of June. So isolating Belarus in terms of its borders is very much a realistic possibility. And it is one that would, of course, have a lot of supply chain disruption risks as well if Lithuania and Latvia also decided to implement measures as such.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, while it's short of a retaliation that I think could spark, you know, a wider conflict in that area and lead to an inevitable NATO-Russian exchange. However, as you say, if all three countries close their borders to Belarus, that's going to have quite catastrophic impacts on organizations and businesses that rely on those avenues, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. And I think it's one that would have to be considered very carefully by these governments, but it isn't one that is without merit. I think a military conflict, so a military sort of solution, is something that is highly unlikely. Wagner would not want to openly attack a NATO country because, well, that would ensue Article 5. It's not something they'd like to go down. And as well, Belarus has said for quite a long time, it's made accusations that NATO would want to attack Belarus, to invade Belarus, basically using Poland. So feeding into those narratives, taking anything further on a military conflict route is not in the interests of either party, especially not NATO's.
Sure. Now, and you know, you do iterate this throughout your daily reporting. We're now kicking off a monthly forecast report, but whenever we do a bi-weekly webinar on Ukraine, as most people listening to this know, and whenever we do, we always get these questions, you know, so it is a real concern because whilst, you know, it's highly unlikely, the impact of a evocation of Article 5 would be a game changer. So thanks for clearing that up. Thank you for telling us what Wagner are doing in Belarus. Just the final one that all our clients always ask, Prigozhin, how long has he got left before he falls out of a window?
This is something I don't think is within my ability to, mention, but I think Prigozhin, given the fact that he can essentially go to and from Russia, I think he is very much safe for the moment. I mean, Putin, of course, does have a very bad track record of, you know, assassinating dissidents within Russia and also abroad. But the thing with Prigozhin is that he never criticized Putin during the mutiny. It was always aimed at, you know, the military leadership. So that's another element that is most likely going to keep Prigozhin from falling out of windows anytime soon.
For now.
Yeah.
But I'd avoid drinking any tea if I was him. Yes. Maybe switch to coffee instead. Okay, Leila Guest, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And that's it for another episode of Sibylline Insights. Please do remember to like and subscribe, however you got this podcast. Thank you to my co-host, Leo Collins, Kaylin Johnson from our cyber desk, and of course, Leila Guest. The show notes will contain our email address. Please do feel free to give us a quick email and reach out with any questions that you have. Until then, we'll see you the next time for another episode of Sibylline Insights.